But anyway, suffice it to say, I'm going to be on my absolute best behavior. I'm going to be jumping and running around stage, making you feel like it was worth your while to come in for the early lecture. Okay, so... So first of all, husband comes home late at night, and he's clearly very upset, and his wife says, "No, husband, what's wrong?" And he says, "Oh, I just lost everything. I lost it all. I lost all of our money gambling downstairs with Gregory Ivanovich." His wife says, "Oh, you poor dear." And she goes over to the window of their apartment and she opens it and she leans out and she says, "Gregory Ivanovich." And a window opens downstairs, and he says, "What?" And she says, "You'll never get your money." And she slams the window, and she says, "There, dear, you let him worry for a little bit." She says, "There." Did I mumble that too much, or was it just not funny at all? She says, "There, dear, you let him worry for a little bit." No. Okay. So you did hear it. Okay. I brought that on myself. Okay. I'm achieving new levels of response to these jokes. Okay. So this lecture, you get to meet George Gamow and his two great discoveries. I actually don't know the right way to spell his first name, this is probably the Anglification is George. BBN, Big Bang Nucleosynthesis, and the CMB, the Cosmic Microwave Background. Okay, so this stands for Big Bang Nucleosynthesis. And this for Cosmic Microwave Background. These are our two, earliest observational tests that the Big Bang picture of the universe is correct back to very early times. So this realization, in modern terms, tells us that the picture, it gives us observational evidence that the picture really is correct all the way back to a mere 1 second after the Big Bang. So when the universe was basically a billionth of its, everything was a billion times closer together, the universe was 10 to the minus 27, its current size. And here, this happened at a later time. The cosmic microwave background was released when everything was a factor of 1,000 closer together, or the universe was a billionth of its current size. But this is just as significant, because this is our cleanest, most pristine, accurate source of just a treasure trove of information about the early universe. So we've been able to learn an enormous amount of detail about the early universe by studying the statistics of the fluctuations in this guy. So these two things were both discovered, were both realized by basically one person in more or less one paper back in the 1940s, decades before anyone else was thinking about it, and the paper was then basically forgotten. So he's awesome. And the coolest thing about these things is that he had this sort of style that was very, very much very, very simple arguments leading to very profound conclusions. And both of these things will be able to, follow his train of thought and work out the essence in, you know, in half a lecture each. Okay, but before we do that, let me just say a few words about what we were talking about in the previous lecture. Okay, so the last lecture was about thermodynamics and stat-mech in an expanding space-time. And so the first thing to say is I rewrote these notes last night, and so there will be a new version of them posted on the wiki soon. Anyway, I'm not going to go through it again, but the new notes give a more streamlined presentation. So let me re-summarize what we did last time, as if we did it in this nicer, more streamlined form. Oh, I should also say that in the process of streamlining these notes, I also went back to the first set of lecture notes about introducing GR and the stress energy tensor and updated those. So those will also be on the wiki shortly. But so basically, I've just added a section in the first set of lecture notes where starting from the action for a bunch of point particles. So the action for a bunch of point particles is just the sum over all the particles, or minus the sum over all the particles of their mass times the integral of their proper time over their world line. So imagine that that's the matter part of the action, and we saw in that first lecture that given the matter part of the action, you could vary it with respect to the metric and get the stress energy tensor. And so when we vary this thing, we get, so I derive a expression in the first part, in the first lecture now, in the first set of lecture notes, the expression for the stress energy tensor due to a collection of point particles, basically. And so then the idea is that by comparing that expression, the point particle expression, with the expression for the stress energy tensor of a perfect fluid, you can determine that. So in terms of, we introduced this distribution function yesterday, the ith species has distribution f sub I, which is in general a function on phase space. And for example, if we want to get the number density of the ith species, we would integrate this, we would just integrate over all values of p at a given x and t. And then to get the energy density, to get the expression for the energy density and the pressure of this species, you compare this point particle stress energy tensor with the perfect fluid stress energy tensor and find that it's, so this expression, this first expression we wrote down yesterday, we just justified it in a different, slightly different way. So there's an extra factor of the energy in the integrand for this guy. And for the pressure, by the comparison, you find instead that the extra factor is p squared, spatial p squared over 3 times the energy. Okay, so then from there we plug in the we imagine we consider the case of a quantum ideal gas of bosons or fermions in thermal equilibrium, and so the distribution function is the the canonical one, the Bose-Einstein or the Fermi-Dirac distribution function. Where the minus one applies for bosons and the plus one applies for fermions. So you plug that distribution function into these expressions, change the integration variable from p to energy, and then evaluate those integrals in two limits. First, there's the relativistic limit, where the temperature of the ith species is much greater than its mass or its chemical potential. And there we said that on dimensional grounds, you find that ni, you can figure out that ni has to be just proportional to ti cubed. And there's a particular proportionality constant that is one of the things that you'll work out on the homework. And rho I is proportional to ti to the fourth, again on dimensional grounds with a proportionality constant, which you'll work out on the homework. And then pi you'll find is just 1/3 times rho I. So this is just this gives a direct derivation of what a different way to derive the thing we were saying before, that a relativistic fluid has W is equal to 1/3. Remember, W is this so-called equation of state parameter defined as the ratio of pressure to energy density. Okay, so you get these relativistic expressions, and then in the non-relativistic limit, you find, again, you can evaluate these three integrals with this distribution function in the non-relativistic limit, and you find some expression like for the number density, and for the energy density, well, the energy density in the non-relativistic limit is just the mass times the number density. And the pressure in this limit is just the temperature times the number density. And so again, this gives a direct derivation of another fact that we had derived in a different way previously, that in the non-relativistic limit where Ti is much less than Mi, if we take the ratio of pressure to energy density, the Ni's drop out, it's just T over Mi, which is small. So Pi over rho I, which is W for the ith species, is approximately zero in the non-relativistic limit. Okay, so these three formulae evaluated in these two limits, these are very useful formulae to have derived once in your life. You use them again and again in cosmology. So both the relativistic expressions, these three guys, and the non-relativistic expressions, these three guys. As we said, these give a direct stat-mech derivation of the equation of state parameter W in the two regimes. In the relativistic regime, you get W equals 1/3. In the non-relativistic regime, you get W is approximately equal to zero. So this is all so checking these formulae is one of the subjects of the homework assignment for the coming week. And then finally, we so far we've just been discussing equilibrium thermodynamics just in various different limits. Finally, we want to put in the expansion of the universe and extract what are the essential effects. And the first most important thing to say is that if we look at this relativistic case, well, first of all, we said by looking at the first law of thermodynamics yesterday, dE is equal to TdS minus P dV. That's Td capital S, Td entropy. And then by writing each of these extrinsic quantities, the energy and the entropy, as a product of an intrinsic density times volume. So and ds we wrote as d entropy density times volume. In equilibrium, or in quasi-equilibrium, and if the chemical potentials are negligible, which is again this case, these intrinsic quantities P, S, and B, intrinsic means they're independent. They don't scale with the volume of the total volume of the system. They're local densities. They only depend on temperature. So we expanded this out with the understanding that now the only two independent variables in this differential relation are V and T. And so we collected the coefficients of dT and we collected the coefficients of dV, and one of those collections led to the equation S is equal to rho plus P over T, which in other words is just 4/3 times this expression for rho divided by T. So in other words, it's proportional. The important thing to say is that it's proportional to T cubed. On the other hand, again, that's just a fact about thermodynamics, thermal equilibrium for a relativistic system. On the other hand, we said that if the expansion of the universe is quasi-adiabatic, in other words, the rate at which the universe is expanding is much slower than the rate at which the various reactions that are leading to equilibrium are taking place. So if H, the expansion rate, the time that it takes, let's say, for one e-fold of expansion of the universe, for A to increase by a factor of, you know, order of E, if that is much less than the reaction rates that are responsible for keeping particles in equilibrium, then equilibrium happens before the particles have time to feel the expansion. Everything is very adiabatic, like when you very slowly expand a piston. So there's essentially no creation of entropy, which is created by non-adiabatic changes. So the total entropy is conserved, and so just like any conserved quantity, the physical density of that conserved quantity in an expanding universe has to go down as a to the minus 3, because the volume is going up as a to the 3 as the universe expands, and the density times the volume has to remain fixed. So S, like any conserved quantity, like the density of any conserved quantity, has to go like a to the minus 3. And from this, we infer the all-important fact that T goes like a to the minus 1. Okay, so as the universe expands, it cools according to precisely this law. And then the final point that we made in the previous lecture was that so if we think about the universe expanding and cooling, it's a gas of many different particle species with various different masses, and as it continues to expand, the temperature will drop and drop and drop until it falls below one of those masses. And when it falls below one of those masses, that species is going to change over from this behavior, where its density is diluting mildly as just a power of T, to this behavior, where suddenly its density wants to dilute away exponentially with decreasing T. And so, in fact, what happens is that it can't just continue diluting exponentially forever, because it gets so rarefied that the condition for thermal equilibrium can no longer be maintained. The reaction rates involving those particles get extremely low because there just aren't any particles around to be involved in those reactions. And so instead what happens is that, this formula continues to hold until that equilibrium condition breaks. And then after that point, this formula ceases to be relevant. And so if that particle, let's say, is a quantity that is stable on its own, if it's just, you know, floating through empty space on its own, if it's a stable particle, then henceforth its number density will just scale like the density of a conserved quantity. It'll scale instead as a to the minus 3. So this process where suddenly a particle species gets so rare that it can't maintain thermal equilibrium anymore, can't maintain its equilibrium abundance, is called decoupling. That particle decouples from the thermal plasma, and in particular, it's it sometimes also goes under the name freeze-out, where that's often particularly used to describe processes like the one that is hypothesized to have given rise to the dark matter abundance today, where you had a dark matter particle chi and its antiparticle that were maintaining their thermal abundance, let's say, by going back and forth between two photons. But then when the temperature dropped below the mass of this particle, it became exponentially rare until finally this equation could no longer go both ways. A chi particle just would not be able to find within the age of the universe, would not be likely to run into another of its antiparticles to annihilate with. And so instead, what happens is that if this is the only way that chi particles can be created or destroyed, if they can't be created or destroyed on their own, then they just sit around for the rest of the age of the universe. And so, yeah? So yeah, that's a good question. Well, we'll do that calculation in a future. The question is when does it? So there's two things to say about that. What we really mean by rare is when does its number density become low enough that this condition fails to be satisfied? So you'll see that happens in the early universe, and when that happens in the early universe, the dark matter is a tiny fraction of the energy density. It becomes a bigger and it then subsequently, after it freezes out, becomes a bigger and bigger fraction of the energy density as the universe evolves. So that today it's 25%, but back then it was a very tiny fraction of the energy density. Okay, yeah. So that's the. If I had to do it again, that would have been the flow through last lecture. Okay, so that's my kind of fictionalized review of what we did last lecture. Okay, so now, so maybe we're now in a position before moving on to Gamow to just, you know, draw a picture of what is the, without giving you the observational evidence for this, let me just, as a brief interlude, give a picture of, you know, what these standard model of cosmology is at the moment, what the model is that appears to fit the data better than any other model that people have come up with so far. Okay, so if we draw energy density on this axis, or log of energy density on this axis, and log of the scale factor on this axis, so as the universe expands, we're moving along this axis. Okay, so there's one component. I took quantum field theory from this guy, Mark Wise, and when he was about to use colored chalk, he would always begin to start talking about it, and he would say, he had this great way of saying colored chalk, that I wanted to do that now, but then I couldn't find colored chalk. Anyway, okay, so there is one component of the universe, which is radiation, and its energy density is dropping is a to the minus 4. So this is supposed to be a line with slope minus 4. And then there's matter density. So this is non-relativistic matter. So this is you know, another way to say it is this is matter with equation of state W equals 1/3. Then there's matter density, whose energy density falls as a to the minus 3. That's supposed to be slope a to the minus 3. Slope minus 3. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, okay. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate the thought, but now. And then there appears to be another component needed to fit the data, which goes under the name of dark energy or cosmological constant or vacuum energy, and it appears to scale as a to the 0, in other words, to not dilute. And so, okay. So there are some key epochs in the history of the universe. So this is today, let's say, right about here. Okay, that's today. So today, the dark energy is about twice as abundant as the matter density, two or three times as abundant as the matter density. In the very recent past, so when the universe was about half its current volume, or in other words, when the scale factor was about cube root of 2, it's, you know, cube root of half of its current size, so not very long ago in the grand scheme of things, there was this moment where the two guys crossed one another, so dark energy, matter equality. And I mean, that was in the late universe. Like, galaxies had already formed, you know, people on other galaxies were already having cosmology classes, and this is quite recently. Then there's an earlier epoch here, very important one called matter radiation equality, where the matter density and the radiation density crossed. So matter radiation equality. And then prior to that, there was a long epoch, many, many e-folds, in which the universe was radiation dominated. And then, hypothetically, let's say the most popular belief at the moment among cosmologists is that many, many e-folds earlier than that, there was another epoch where the energy density again went like a to the zero, roughly speaking, like it appears to be doing today. But whereas today's dark energy density has this very low value, the early energy density that is hypothesized to have driven inflation was many orders of magnitude larger. Anyway, and so then this moment where that nearly constant energy density decayed into radiation, into a bath of particles of initially who knows what, and eventually the standard model particles, that's called reheating. That's called the moment of reheating. And then the two other moments that we're going to meet in this lecture now are the moment at which the cosmic microwave background was produced, and the moment at which Big Bang nucleosynthesis took place. So this is all going to not do a very good job of being to scale, but so again, this is today. This is when the universe was, you know, cube root of a half smaller. Almost, you know, not very much smaller at all, when the scale factor was a cube root of a half smaller. Here, this is when the scale matter radiation equality was when the scale factor was, you know, 3,500 times smaller, several thousand times smaller than it is today. When it was 1,000 times smaller than it is today, or 1,100 times smaller than it is today, that was the moment where the cosmic microwave background radiation was released. Okay, so that's one thing that Gamow was responsible for realizing, and that we'll talk about. And when it was a billion times, when the scale factor was a billion times smaller than it is today, so when the universe was 10 to the minus 27 of its current volume, so somewhere quite a bit further this way, but it's also supposed to be quite far away from when inflation ended, so I'm just going to draw it in the middle here. It was during the radiation-dominated epoch, is the moment of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which is another thing that George Gamow discovered and is our earliest bit of evidence that our Big Bang model is correct. Okay, so with that basic picture of how things evolve, let's talk about George. Let's say a word. This guy, I feel, deserves a word or two. Okay, so somehow, there are these very influential personalities, and whether they know it or not, everyone for like decades following them has, you know, it seeps into their psyche that that's the way you're supposed to do physics. So there was Einstein and Bohr, and these were, they you know, there's a lot of thought experiments and philosophical discussions, and they made these great discoveries, and everyone thought that was how you were supposed to do physics. And for decades, physicists all thought, you know, having philosophical discussions and, you know, point of principle thought experiments was a very important part of doing physics. And then, okay, and then some time went by, and those guys stopped getting breakthrough results. And then Feynman came along, and he was another incredibly charismatic personality. Did get great results. Repudiated this view. You know, he was, you know, philosophy is crap. You should just shut up and calculate. You know, if you can calculate the correct answer to an experimental result, you know, I don't want to hear any more talk about what it means or you know whether it's philosophically pleasing. And so that has become, you know, that to this day is definitely the dominant sentiment among physicists, basically because of Feynman. And then more recently, and this is like very, you know, apparent around perimeter especially, there's Ed Witten and Juan Maldacena, these two very great physicists, and the that's seeped in is like as in the back of their mind is like the pinnacle of good physics or something like that. So George Gamow, it's just good to like see examples of people who just had very different styles. Just kind of break out of the mold. So George Gamow is a guy who made just again and again, you know, extremely important discoveries, but was very different from any of those people that we just described. He was very, I don't know. I mean, there's nothing better than to just give a few, we'll see a few examples of what he did and how he did it, but it's very elementary arguments, just sort of noticing things, noticing what taking something seriously and doing a little bit of simple algebra implies. So, you know, my favorite example of what he did actually is not a cosmology thing. Right after the double helix was discovered. So George Gamow was the one who discovered that the DNA code is a triplet code. And his argument, so DNA comes in four different letters, you know, and somehow people understood that there was this long code written in four letters, and somehow it was coding for all the complicated proteins that do all the business of making your cells run. And so the question was how was the code working? And he just said, well, he knew that there were four letters in the alphabet, and he knew that there were 22 amino acids that were being strung together to make proteins. So he just said, well, the simplest thing is, you know, it couldn't be that every letter here is coding for an amino acid, because there's only four letters, and so you can't code for 22 amino acids with four letters, and it can't be that pairs of letters are coding, because with pairs of four letters you can only code for 16 different amino acids. So the minimum thing you need to code for 22 amino acids is if every triplet is a three-letter word coding for an amino acid. And so he just, you know, and probably it's hard for evolution to evolve something sophisticated like that, so probably the simplest thing is the one that's correct. And that was right. So that was, he knew like nothing about biology, and let's talk about his, this is a cosmology course, so let's do his two cosmology examples. So another thing which we won't talk about, so let's talk about Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So one of the thing that he's maybe most famous for actually is he was one of these in the 40s and 50s, there was, people didn't know how to be, quantum field theory was not at all understood. Yet there were these very clever people like Fermi and Gamov and, I don't know. There's another guy named Willie Fowler and another guy named Fred Hoyle, Hans Bethe, who somehow were, even though quantum field theory was like pure witchery at that point, they were able to calculate a lot of stuff with it by hook or by crook. And so in particular, they got interested in the question of, you know, here's the periodic table. Okay, that's the periodic table, and you know they so you look out in the universe and almost everything in the universe, 75% of the universe by mass is hydrogen, and then the remaining 25% is helium. And then there's just a sprinkling of everything else. And they were just interested in figuring out where did all of this stuff come from, and relatedly, how do stars shine? Okay, they kind of quickly figured out that those two things were very closely related to one another. So these people, and maybe I'm forgetting some people, worked out in great detail how the you know, stars are basically nuclear reactors, and they're fusing different nuclei in the periodic table to make other nuclei, and they worked out in detail the nuclear processes by which this happened, and they got all sorts of predictions for what should be the relative abundances of various of these elements, and in particular, you know, they understood how, basically, roughly speaking, all of the elements up to iron are fused in the centers of stars, basically in a thermal equilibrium reactor at the center of stars, just the crushing gravity and temperature at the center of a star, and thermal equilibrium wants to bind lighter elements into heavier ones up to iron, and then beyond that you don't get them in the center of stars. All the heavier stuff like uranium and thorium and, you know, notably these guys, these elements that feature in nuclear weapons and nuclear reactors. Now, everything heavier than iron is produced in non-equilibrium processes when a star dies and explodes. It sends out a shockwave, a very non-equilibrium shockwave that creates basically everything heavier than iron. Okay, so that was all fine. They understood really enormous amount of detail about that, but they could not account for the abundances of the light elements that way. So the first four elements basically were clearly, you know, Gamov began to realize that they clearly were not explained by either cooking in the centers of stars or in supernova explosions. So he was the one who realized that the correct explanation was probably that these first four abundances were produced in the first few seconds after the Big Bang, when the universe was hot enough to do the same fusion processes that are going on in the centers of stars. And so let's just quickly see again. It's a great example of a back of the envelope calculation by which you can see that it's probably on the right track. So the universe is expanding and cooling, and let's just get some scales in our head first. So the hottest temperature you could probably think about reasonably is the Planck scale. The hottest temperature that anyone thinks about is the Planck scale. So if you set h bar is equal to c is equal to unity, you'll find that g Newton has units of 1/(mass²). So if you take g Newton to the -1/2, that has units of mass, or in other words, it has units of energy or temperature. And so that energy scale is called the Planck scale, and it is about 10 to the 19 GeV, giga electron volts. Yeah. I should say, this is kind of my mode throughout, is that I almost always, I forget to say, but I'm almost always setting these three constants to one. And then this mass scale I will sometimes write, just to remind, instead of writing G Newton, I'll replace G Newton to the minus 1/2 by the Planck mass, which is this energy of 10 to the 19 GeV. Okay, and then about a factor of 100 or 1,000 below that, at about 10 to the 17 or 10 to the 18, I mean 10 to the 16 or 10 to the 17 GeV, there is that is the hypothetical gut scale at which the gauge groups of the standard model are unified into a single gauge group, which might be SO10. This is still definitely a hypothetical scale. And then you go down many orders of magnitude to 1 TeV, so in other words, 10 to the 3 GeV. That's kind of, those are the scales being probed by the LHC right now. Those are the collision energies at the LHC. Another factor of 10 below that, 100 GeV, those are the masses of the weak bosons. That's kind of the weak scale. So this is the mass of the W boson, mass of the Z boson. And then another quite a bit lower than that. Well, okay, let's say, you know, another factor of 100 below that, 1 GeV, that's like the mass of the proton and neutron. And then another factor of 1,000 below that, 1 MeV, that's the mass difference between the proton and neutron. And it's also the mass of the electron. Okay, and then way below that are the masses of the light neutrinos. So the universe, we don't really know at what temperature the radiation-dominated era started. But let's assume it started somewhere, you know, somewhere above 10 GeV. Okay, that the standard radiation-dominated era with standard model particles was got going sometime before 10 GeV. So, you know, what particles are, so at 10 GeV, protons, 10 GeV is about 10 times the mass of the proton and the neutron. So the protons, antiprotons, neutrons, antineutrons, those were still relativistic at that point. They were still very abundant. They had about the same abundance as photons, all relativistic particles. By these formula up here, every relativistic species has about the same abundance. It's the same prefactor times the temperature cubed. And there's also electrons and positrons and neutrinos and photons. Okay, so anyway, then, so those guys are all in equilibrium at about the same abundance, and then the universe cools down to 1 GeV, and suddenly these first four are no longer relativistic. Equilibrium wants to make them go away. Their number density begins to be exponentially suppressed. So these guys all want to annihilate with one another, and these guys all want to annihilate with one another. And that's what they do. But they can't completely annihilate because, and this is a key unexplained fact about the universe that still awaits a proper explanation, because for every billion antiprotons in the early universe, there were a billion and one protons. And so after every antiproton annihilated, there was still, for every billion antiprotons that annihilated, there was still one proton left over that had nobody to annihilate with. And same thing here. So which is why today the number density of, or the I should, no, that's not right. The relative abundance of photons of baryons, these particles are all examples of baryons, or I mean these particles are baryons and these particles are antibaryons. So the number density of baryons over photons today is something like 10 to the minus 9, and again that's a thing that That's an observed fact about the universe that currently requires an explanation and doesn't seem to be explained by the standard model of particle physics alone. So once we're below 1 GeV, once the temperature is below 1 GeV, we just have some protons and some neutrons left over. They're non-relativistic now. And so they obey that non-relativistic number density relation. And so because the neutron is slightly more massive than the proton, thermal equilibrium is weighted against it. Its number density is suppressed relative to the slightly less massive proton. And basically, roughly speaking, the leading thing is comes from the ratio of the exponential factors for each species and the difference in mass. So in other words, so as the universe is cooling, as long as these guys remain in thermal equilibrium, once they've become non-relativistic, the abundance of neutrons over the abundance of protons is roughly the exponential of minus their mass difference over temperature. And if the temperature got very low, this would correspond to enormously suppressing neutrons relative to protons. But again, this expression will only stay true as long as the abundances of these two particles remain in thermal equilibrium. So the main sort of reaction that keeps these things in equilibrium is a sort of four fermion interaction that where let's say a neutron goes to proton, electron, and antineutrino, or neutron plus neutrino go to proton plus electron, or anyway, various all possible permutations of which of these particles are the in particles and out particles. So in other words, for example, one. A neutron can decay to a proton plus an electron antineutrino, or any possible permutation that's obtained by crossing. So I'm allowed to, for example, bring the P over to this side if I change it to an anti-P. And so on. I'm allowed to just drag particles across the arrow there as long as I change them to their antiparticles on the other side. But anyway, So Gamov would have known that all of those processes are basically described by a Feynman diagram, what would later be called a Feynman diagram what would later be called a Feynman diagram, with four fermions coming together with a coupling constant, G Fermi, the Fermi constant. And if we want to remember briefly what the Fermi constant is, from a more modern standpoint, what this diagram is. So this diagram, this is okay. This is really a neutron is really two down quarks and an up quark. So this is a down quark, one of the down quarks. Going to an up quark, and then there's another down quark that just goes along for the ride, another up quark that just goes along for the ride. So these three guys make a proton up here, these three guys make a neutron down here. Anyway, so ignore those two things. They're just going along for the ride. The diagram is an exchange of a W boson. And so if we just want to estimate, this diagram just reduces to this one in the limit where the momentum exchange along the W boson is small relative to the mass. So the propagator here, in other words, a propagator would be something like, you know, 1 over p squared minus m squared, but we're in the limit where p squared is very small. This is scattering and energy is much below the mass of the W boson. So this diagram is, very roughly speaking, okay, there's a propagator which is like 1 over the mass of the weak boson squared, and then there's some coupling constants here, so there's a factor of g squared, which it's not really important what they, so they're small but not too small. So let's say we take g is equal to 0.3, so g squared is equal to 1/10, and then the weak boson is about 100 GeV squared. So this is 1/10 times 1 over 100 GeV squared squared. So that's 10 to the minus 5 GeV to the minus 2. I guess no one on that side can see that. So I was just, I'm estimating the Fermi constant by saying, you know, what do we know, what actual diagram reduces to the Fermi constant in the standard model? And it's something like a weak coupling constant squared divided by the W mass squared. The W mass is 100 GeV, so this is something like 10 to the minus 5 GeV to the minus 2. Okay, so now what we want to know, we want to just quickly estimate when does this diagram, when does this scattering, when do these various scattering processes that maintain the thermal equilibrium abundances of N and P, and therefore maintain the validity of this formula, when do those things freeze out? In other words, when does the rate for processes like this drop below the Hubble rate? That's the condition for a freeze out. Well, on this side, if you ever have a Feynman diagram, you know, that gives you an amplitude. To get a rate is a probability. You're supposed to take the square of it. You know, in quantum mechanics, you take the square of probabilities. So if the amplitude goes as GF, we have to square it if we're trying to estimate the rate. And then, in a classic cosmologist trick in the style of Gamow, you know, normally when you want to go from a Feynman diagram to an actual cross section or a rate, you have to do various integrals over the phase space of the initial and or final particles as appropriate, right? The momenta of range and phase space that's relevant for the process. But I mean, here we just want to get an order of magnitude understanding of what's even going on. So I'm just going to argue it this way, that a decay rate has units of energy. It's number per unit time, and again, in units where h bar is equal to c is equal to 1, 1 over time has units of energy. So I have to get units of energy. At the moment, I have units of 1 over energy to the fourth, because each G Fermi goes as 1 over energy squared. So I have to multiply by energy to the fifth, and at temperatures above 1 MeV, in other words, when we're initially considering this process, let's say we've dropped below 1 GeV and we haven't yet gotten down to 1 MeV and we're trying to estimate what is the rate in that period. Well, you'll get contributions here, terms with the fifth power of all different combinations of any dimensionful constant in town, but the relevant dimensionful constants here are the temperature. The relevant dimensionful quantities are the temperature and then the mass splitting between the neutron and proton, because that's some kinetic energy that gets released during a conversion process like this, or the mass difference between the electron and the neutrino. That's some other kinetic energy that gets released. So those are both 1 MeV. So when the temperature is at 1 MeV or above, we can estimate this process. The dominant term will be this. The biggest dimensionful quantity taken to the right power to get the dimensions correct. Okay? So that's my estimate for the rate at which this process is going on. And then, well, to estimate H, I can just say, so the Friedman equation says that H is equal to 8 pi g over 3 rho. And for rho, I can plug in that expression pi squared over 30 times t to the fourth and times the number of species that are contributing to rho. That's the expression for one species. we may have of order 10 species hanging around. So we have 8 pi over 3. I'm going to use my trick where I write G Newton as 1 over m Planck squared. And then rho is pi squared over 30 times the number of relativistic degrees of freedom, that's of order 10, times t to the fourth. And then this is h squared. We want to take the square root of this whole thing. So we have a constant times t to the fifth here, another constant times the square root of t to the fourth over here. We just want to solve for t to find the temperature at which these two sides are equal and freeze-out occurs. Okay, so if you do that, so let's say we squared both sides here. So if we square both sides and divide by G Fermi to the fourth. Okay, to save time, let me just talk through the algebra a little bit here. So if we squared both sides, we would have G Fermi to the fourth, t to the tenth. We would have all this crap times t to the fourth. Let's divide both sides by t to the fourth, so that now we just have a t to the sixth on this side, and let's divide both sides by G Fermi to the fourth, so that t to the sixth is all by itself over there, and we get something like one over G Fermi to the fourth. Okay, so one over G Fermi to the fourth, well, that's the same as, okay, let's first get rid of these order one factors. So pi and 3 cancel, 10 and 30 cancel to become 1 over 3. This 3 kills a pi. I don't know. Let's this pi and this 8. 25. So then this is 1 over 10 to the 19 GeV squared, and this is 10 to the 5 GeV squared to the fourth power. Okay, so putting everything together, GeV to the 8 divided by GeV squared is GeV to the 6th. Is GeV to the 6th. And then we have 10 to the 20 from here divided by 10 to the 38. So we have 10 to the minus 17 GeV to the 6th is T to the 6th. T frees out to the 6th. So taking the 6th root, we get that t is about 10 to the minus 3 GeV, or in other words, 1 MeV. Okay? So George Gamow would do this calculation, and he would say, aha, isn't that interesting? The energy at which this process froze out, the temperature at which this process froze out, 1 MeV, that happens to be almost equal to the mass difference between the proton and the neutron. So in fact, if you do the calculation a little bit more carefully, at the moment of freeze out, so we said that as long as thermal equilibrium is maintained, m neutron minus m proton over t is the ratio of the neutron to proton abundance. And so I said this is about 1 MeV. More carefully, this is like, if you look it up, this is 1.35 or something MeV, that mass difference. And if you did the temperature freeze-out calculation a little bit more carefully, you'd find that it was 0.8 MeV or something like that. So anyway, if you exponential of minus 1.35 over 0.8 turns out is about 1/6. Okay, and then because the neutron by itself is unstable, it doesn't just sit there forever. It's actually slowly decaying. So it turns out that by the time that the neutrons get gobbled up by helium, which they will do in a moment, this is, allow me to fudge this down to 1/7 to make my point here. Okay, so at the moment of freeze out, the there are 1/7 as many neutrons as protons. And then, as soon as the universe gets cold enough that it's cooler than the binding energy of helium, helium is this very tightly bound nucleus. It loves to soak up neutrons. Neutrons don't like to live on their own. They like to live in helium. They love living in helium. And so that's what happens. When as soon as the universe gets cold enough, every one of those neutrons gets bound into a helium-4 atom. So helium-4 has two neutrons and two protons. And then the rest, everything that's left over is just protons. Those are all the hydrogen atoms. So let's just calculate what is the abundance of what fraction of the universe is in helium after this process happens. Well, the mass density in helium is, well, there's two for every two neutrons, we get one helium atom. So the number density of helium atoms after this happens will be half the number density of neutrons. And then the mass of each helium atom is 4 atomic units. And then the total mass in the universe is just the number density of neutrons times 1 atomic mass unit plus the number density of protons times 1 atomic mass unit. Okay, so now if we just simplify, if we just divide, you know, the numerator and denominator by n sub p, this becomes, so 4 times 1/2 is 2, and then n neutron divided by n sub p over 1 plus n neutron over n sub p. So we plug in 1/7 for both of these things. So we have 2 times 1/7 over 1 plus 1/7. And that is equal to 1/4. So, which is the observed fraction of the universe that is in helium. So, that's the calculation. It's very sloppy and crude, but it immediately shows you that this is a more promising route than getting it from stars, where you can't get anywhere near this abundance of helium. And so then, once you get the idea, once a crummy little calculation like this gives you the idea that this is probably the way the universe actually did it, you can go back and do a more detailed code that, you know, involves all the nuclear. You can have a computer chug through, you know, the differential equations that you know, you have all your measured reaction rates for all the different nuclear reactions, and you start with your initial conditions and let it run forward, and you can calculate detailed abundances for all the different light isotopes, all the different, you know, hydrogen, and then hydrogen with a neutron, which is deuterium, and helium-3, helium-4, the various isotopes of lithium and beryllium. You can calculate those all in detail, and now in modern cosmology, compare those to observations, so the fit is sufficiently good that there's no question that this is more or less correct. So anyway, it's awesome. So I didn't get to the CMB today. I didn't get to it in this lecture, but I'm giving a second lecture at my normal time at 11, and we'll do the CMB then and then get started on dark matter. Okay? But the CMB also has this flavor. You get a lot for very little input. It's cool.